This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
5 a.m., I'm up with a crisp Celsius energy drink. Running 12 miles today. Grab a green juice, quick change, and head to work. Meetings, workshops, one more Celsius, no slowing down. Working late, but obviously still meeting the girls for a little dancing. Celsius. Live. Fit. Go. Grab a cold, refreshing Celsius at your local retailer or locate now at Celsius.com.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands for the super athletic stuff, like running gear for cruising up the trail. Woo! And the super athletic-ish stuff, like fishing gear for chilling by the creek. Nice cast. Fitness apparel to push for higher reps? You got this! And golf balls priced so you can afford to lose one. Or a few. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
Welcome, everyone. My name is Jacob. Thank you for joining me. This is Hunt Detail. I am back from my Colorado elk hunt, and it's good to be back. It was an absolute grind, but I do view these trips as business trips. I don't look at them as sort of sitting around campfires and that sort of thing. It really is for me about filling a tag, and unfortunately, I did not fill a tag, so I'll sort of let the cat out of the bag up front here, but I do feel really good about my hunt plan, my approach, the intensity, and where I left off on the previous podcast was that solo mountain mindset. And I had some goals there about really trying to enjoy the journey, trying to demonstrate patience, and trying to maintain that self-confidence that you belong there, that you deserve an opportunity. And I think I checked all those boxes. And as I unpack this hunt, maybe you'll pick up on some of that. I think in the past, I would metric my days in the field. Like, for example, in a previous elk hunt, I would metric my days. Like, did you kill or did you not? If you did not, then it was failure. And that would weigh sort of heavy on me. It also... And just to give you a little bit of background, I hunted elk in 2018, killed a bull in a western state on a general tag with my bow at 30 yards, shot him in the chest. It was awesome. I didn't know that I shouldn't. It was a spot and stalk, or not spot and stalk. I was sort of slipping into a bedding area, and I just had buckets and buckets full of confidence and made that happen. And so in a lot of ways, that hunt was life-changing. It was really impactful, and it set the fire for future elk hunts. So I went last year in 2023 to Wyoming on a general tag. I had done a fantastic job of e-scouting and hunt prep and was really in elk pretty much every day in some capacity. But I could not put it together. But I will also say that I left some days on the table, and I let work and I let home sort of pull me out early. And so that was my biggest frustration, because last year, I think I was metricing my days of, did you kill or did you not kill? And if you didn't kill, it would weigh heavy on me because I knew it delayed my return home, my return to work, and just stuff like that. And I left that hunt dissatisfied because I do feel like I could have filled that tag with a bull. I had passed on some cows at different times, but I wanted to fill that with a bull tag, and I didn't. And that really bothered me. And that's why I wanted to go into this hunt, my third Western elk hunt, with the right mindset and maintain that mindset. And so I think I did accomplish that. I enjoyed the journey. I was more patient and I maintained a high level of confidence that really I deserve any opportunity that presents itself. Now I drew this tag with 0 points. So I did not want to go into the OTC space. I know how crowded that can be and how frustrating that can be. And so, but I also didn't want to burn any of my Colorado points. I had applied to several other states and it just didn't work out. And so I was able to draw this tag and not necessarily deal with the crowds that you see in the OTC space. But I did also know that this was a sort of a lower density elk unit. And, you know, that dynamic did play through, quite honestly. There was not a lot of bugling. It was very intermittent. It didn't seem like there were any satellites bugling. And I don't know if that's a function of the bull to cow ratio. If that sort of gets so high and maybe so out of whack that there's less competition for cows, or I really don't know that interplay, but I just did know that going in that this would be a difficult hunt. On a personal note, I never expect elk to be bugling. Like, I expect to use my woodsmanship. I expect to figure out things based on sign, and in many ways I did do that. I was able to pattern some elk. And I was able to set up on those elk based on those patterns where they weren't talking, but I was having interactions and encounters. So I'm very pleased with my efforts in that regard. There's a phrase it's in boxing or fighting called styles win fights. So if you think about it from the standpoint of boxing, if you have someone that's maybe a southpaw and someone that's a more technical defensive fighter, or someone that is more pure knockout, or even in mixed martial arts, you've got different fighting styles. And so I think one of the great sort of discoveries for me was based, it really helped me understand the style I like to hunt and the setting that would be maybe more appropriate for me based on how I like to hunt. But I'll get into that. I've got a lot of notes here in front of me, so I apologize if it seems like I jump around a little bit. But, you know, going back to the mindset point, I do feel like I accomplished those things. I hit those marks. It was interesting when I was driving out there. It's like going into a deprivation tank where you are letting go of a lot of things that you think about on a day-to-day basis. It's really amazing in terms of the amount of things that you focus on in the workplace or in the family, and then the things that how you let go of those things. And then even still some of the distractions that you allow into your brain during those times. And then when you go out into the field, it really is that deprivation tank where you are disconnected. Now, I was able to get cell service at different spots and be able to text my family and, you know, sort of check up on things like football scores or whatever. But it was an interesting experience, and it's certainly interesting on coming back after that. I was out there for, I guess, maybe 9 days, 8-9 days, not a whole lot of time. I did schedule this sort of earlier in September because of other commitments, and I didn't really want to do that. Last year, I went later than I did this year, but I did want to get some more elk hunt experience under my belt, and so I did want to fit that in. But, going out there, I really wanted to think about elk temperament and not only how they communicate, but also how I communicate. And I think that that was sort of a key phrase for me in terms of interactions with elk. And when they would communicate, what is the temperament? What's going on there? And I think I'm more fluent in elk communication than I was before going out there. Well, it's like almost like when you're taking it, you're going to take a test and you want to cram for that test. And all of a sudden you start really learning a lot new information or more information, or you do all nighters and all of a sudden you feel like, oh, wow, I'm more of an expert on this than I used to be. And I think that that's the way I feel now, that I do have a better understanding of how elk communicate and how I can communicate within that framework. And it's not just a random location bugle, but it's different types, different levels of aggression or emotions, whether it's the mew call, the cow call, or the bugle itself, or even some of the other sounds. But yeah, every day for me while I was out there was, I mean, when I look at these trips, I view them as a business trip. It's not me sort of going out and just hanging out by a campfire or anything like that. I would get up almost every day at 4:30, maybe 4:40, 4:45, before the sun came up. And then I would oftentimes get back to my vehicle at 8:30 or 9. And it was really all about reading sign. I would be calling, I would be bugling, I would be covering ground. And I think for me, it was a bit of a grind, because you're constantly, when you do come back, you're making sure how do I get these things recharged? I got to fill up my water. I got to restock my pack for food. Because when I get up in the next morning, I just want to grab and go. I do think efficiency can win. It's whereas other people are sort of maybe fumbling around at their vehicle, or they forget something. When you have those efficiencies in your plan of, you know, how much water do I need? How am I going to cover my charging needs with my phone and with, any other electronic devices like headlamps, that sort of thing. You've got to have a system there. And I think in a lot of ways, I was doing very well with that, because there were other hunters that were out there and they maybe didn't get up as early as I did. And maybe they came back early to their vehicle or whatever. And I was in the field the entire, as much as humanly possible. Now, there were times where I would pull out, it got really hot at certain times, and I'm just like, you know what, I'm going to take a mental break. And I would go into town and do some, talk to my wife, that sort of thing. But to give you a sense, I'm not going to go through it day by day per se. I will tell you, on day one, I dove back into an area that required a lot of hiking, that was sort of boxed in a lot by private land. And what I found was that I overcommitted myself. I had packed in a ton of food and really more food and more water than maybe I should have. And what I really should have done was just brought a day's worth and just grind and look for elk sign. Because when I got back there, I did cover a lot of ground, but I also had like a really heavy pack. It was a lot. It was way too much. And I didn't find elk sign. And I covered a great deal of ground. And I was like, you know, this isn't going to work. So I started to pull out. I went back to where I had set up camp. And I looked to my right, and there is a bull moose looking at me. And I thought, oh, great, I'll take some pictures and video. This will be cool. And then I'm sure he'll jump. He'll run away here in a second. Well, he didn't run away. He looked at me, and then he stepped forward and sort of hoofed at me. And sort of, you know, I guess I would categorize it as a bluff charge. Now, I don't know if, you know, it felt very intimidating and very scary. And he was about 50 yards from me. And I thought, holy moly, this is not exactly what I thought this was going to be. And then he went and circled downwind of me and did the same thing. And so I'm thinking, wow, okay, it's starting to get dark here. I've got a bull moose that's not intimidated by me. He has got my scent and he wants me to move on. And I'm trying to tear down my camp. And oh, by the way, where he's standing is where I hung my food up in a tree. So I had a pistol. I also had a sort of a noisemaker keychain. It's for, I guess, women, and they keep in their purse or keys on it. And if someone attacks them, they can pull it, makes a loud noise, draws attention. I didn't really carry bear spray. I brought it, but I just didn't want that additional weight and in addition to the pistol. So I pull the keychain. It's, you know, the alarm sounding. He doesn't really care. It didn't bother him. I'm yelling at him, get out of here. I'm thinking I'm going to have to shoot my pistol in the air. I start to videotape everything because I want, if there's going to be a confrontation where he does charge and I have to shoot him, I want it to be documented that there was a real threat there. Obviously, I didn't want to get in any trouble. I really didn't want to shoot a bull moose. I like those things on the landscape, and I'd rather someone take them, harvest them during the hunting season or whatever. But he wasn't having it, and he eventually worked off. This was about a 10-minute standoff, and it was intimidating, though, because where he moved off was the area that I needed to go to get out of this area. Now, I was able to cut through some private land and talk to some locals, and they were really amazing people, really nice people, and really helpful. But it was a really interesting day one experience. Day two, I knew that I wanted to get up high. I had picked out an area that allowed me to sort of truck camp and do circles throughout the area. And so day two, I found a bedding area with some cow elk. Unfortunately, I bumped them, but they didn't smell me. And I felt like, okay, this is an area I can work with. I can go back to. And then, but again, elk weren't really talking at this point. Like there just wasn't, they weren't, you know, unless, you know, I say that because you could be at 10, I was up at 10,000 plus, almost 11,000 feet, and they could be somewhere else and they could be bugling. And so you could be missing out. I mean, I say that they're not talking, but there were times where I set up high and listened over a basin area and just wasn't hearing any elk. So ultimately, day three, I go back to that area. And it's middle of the day, and I rip a bugle, and all of a sudden, I hear below me on this semi-steep slope or mountain, portion of the mountain, crashing. Antlers, I mean, well, sticks breaking, crashing. And I'm like, I bugled, and a few minutes later, this elk bugled, and then I hear the crashing. And so he's on his way up and he's ticked. Now, I don't know if the only thing I can theorize at this point was I'm in between him and his cows or I'm close to his cows. Now, I'm on that same slope where I bumped the cow elk. They were quite a bit higher than where I was, but where I was an area that was clearly frequented by bull moose a lot, bull elk. And because there were rubs at this particular level on the mount, let's say 10-5. And this area, it was a bench. And if it was running east to west, so let's say I'm going up it, headed west up it. So you have a north facing slope and a south facing slope. Those cow elk were bedded on the north side. On the south side is where this bull bugled. It was an odd bugle. It was just a weird sounding bugle. And he was running up it. And so I'm like, oh, wow, okay, this is exciting. And I've got a few seconds to make some decisions here. My scent was running from north to south, so towards his direction. Now, it was afternoon, so those thermals are rising, so it's difficult. It would be difficult for him at the bottom to smell me. But I wanted to make sure that I put myself in an area that would force him to come up all the way without smelling me, but not knowing where he was coming up exactly, I moved towards the end of some downfall. So I knew I could see this downfall was going almost all the way down to his level. So he couldn't get underneath of me. He would have to either go on one side or the other side of this downfall. And I was hoping to get a shot either way. So I was really, looking back, I was really pleased with that decision. Now, I was hoping he would come in front of me, sort of close to where I originally heard him. But he went further back and looped, I guess, back behind me. Because again, I think he wanted to come up and he wanted to smell whatever elk made that bugle. So it forced him to come up, but he came up behind me. Now, this hillside has, this whole area is dark timber. It's full of deadfall. It's very thick. I can see him coming up, and I can see this giant, dark, 6x6, tall, wide, and tons of mass. And he's looking left, right, left, right. I mean, even like a quarter of the way up, he spotted me, or he spotted some movement from me and stared me down. And then I was still, he couldn't see me, And then he decided to keep coming, and he started looking left, right, left, right. I mean, he had a lot of aggression, and he was ready. And he came up to 20 yards from me, and he was looking left and right, and he could not figure out where that bull was. And I was perfectly still, but I think, as we all know, if you stand still, you're still moving. Your muscles are still working to keep you stable. You're still breathing. There was no wind that I could recall, or not a lot of wind anyways, not enough wind to sort of cover my movement. And I could see him at 20 yards. I had an arrow knocked. I was on my, I had my release on, clipped on, and I really needed him to take about two steps to get a shot. An ethical shot. I could see a window to his chest, but he was quartering to me in a way that I couldn't have. I mean, it would have hit his shoulder before it got to any vitals. It was like a dead on shoulder shot the way he was quartered. And the other part of it is that he was so highly locked in that any movement was going to mess it up. So there was a lot of things that would have had to happen. He had come up to almost perfectly parallel to me, and it seemed like he wasn't maybe going to come up all of the way. But ultimately, he looked at me. We had some brush between us, and he stood there staring at me. He could not see my face. I could not see his eyes, but something bothered him, and he shook out of there. It went right back down. I ripped off an aggressive bugle and raked a tree to try to get him to respond emotionally, to come back. Like I almost like a snort wheeze if you were hunting whitetail. And he did not. And so that was a really interesting experience. And that was day three. And it was exciting in a way because this elk was massive. I mean, he was a trophy by any measure. I killed a Pennsylvania elk in 2021, and that elk, I think, scored around 375. And a lot of what you see on those elk are just insane amounts of mass. Very, very thick. And it reminded his the mass on him reminded me of that elk. And it was, I think when you have these lower elk density areas, you have bigger animals. I mean, I think the same goes for whitetail. If you go to some of the states that have lower, or areas in states that have a lower density of whitetail, you tend to find larger bucks. Now, that may, it's not always the case, but it is something that is part of the equation, where you have lower density of deer or lower density of elk, so there's less competition for certain resources, so therefore those resources are more available to those whitetail bucks or those elk, those bull elk there, and they tend to be a little larger. So that was day three, and at that point, I had almost made the decision to put all my chips on the table, because I was starting to learn this area, I was starting to pattern these elk, and I was starting to understand. I obviously found an elk that I wanted to focus in on, and I wanted to, and I knew that he was what I really wanted to fill my tag with. I mean, he was a true trophy. I would say he was in at least 330, and you know, probably closer to 350, and maybe even larger. I'm not somebody that scores elk, but he was, he would have been amazing. Now, I mentioned earlier that styles wins fights. Had I not been solo elk hunting, but had someone with me that was a caller, I would have killed that elk. I'm highly confident of that. I would have had that person drop over the other edge of the ridge, continue to rake a tree off and on. And that bull elk would have, instead of been searching for the source of that sound, would have walked right up on the top of the hill past me at 20 yards. And I'm pretty confident I could have slid an arrow in, because he wouldn't have been focused on any movement. He wouldn't have been focused on me. He would have been focused on moving up and over the lip of that ridge and a little bit past me to where I could pull and drop an arrow right in there. So I guess the broader point here is that when someone chooses to solo elk hunt in dark timber, it's sort of like fighting with one arm behind your back, because the effectiveness of hunting with a partner that does the calling for you is such a much more effective way to kill elk in dark timber. Because when you have someone that's calling 50 yards behind you, the elk are not looking for, they're moving through. They're moving in. And let's say if it was a calling situation, let's say he was up with those cows up higher, embedded with them, and he wanted to come in. And we've all seen this online on YouTube. It's just a more effective way, because the elk is looking through you and past you, not in the spot that you're standing. And so that is a revelation for me coming out of this. And if you look at some of the better elk hunters, I mean, these are guys that have forgotten more than I'll ever know about elk hunting. Brian Barney, Dan Stanton with Elk Shape, Tim Burnett of Solo Hunter. And there's others out there. There's a lot of those folks that they are solo hunters. Brian Barney, Dan Stanton, and Tim Burnett. They're solo elk hunters, and they choose to hunt in areas that allow them to spot and stalk. They're choosing not to call. It allows them to slip in, to ambush. And I think when you're in the dark timber situation, if you're calling, which in a lot of ways you have to, because you can't see the elk movement. And there are other areas that you can hunt elk that are more open. And some of that's private land or whatever. But even still, there are places and states that allow for a different hunting style of solo elk hunting, because you can see the movement more so, and you can make plays against that. I mean, again, even if these elk were more vocal, I still feel like it would have been a little bit of a struggle. I did have other interactions where elk were bugling. Those, unfortunately, didn't work out. And, you know, I probably had interactions almost daily. There were maybe 2 days where I had zero interactions. So I had patterned their movement because I knew where approximately where they fed. I knew where they transitioned through to bedding, and I had some ideas of bedding, but that was a little bit more difficult. That proved to be a little bit more difficult because I found some bedding areas and I had some theories. And so sometimes I could catch them in transition in the morning. And, you know, one of the days I had elk at 10 yards, but it was a cow and a spike bull. And neither of those were legal. This was a bull only tag. It had to have a brow town of 5 inches or longer or 4 points on one side. And so that's where I felt I was very proud and pleased of my effort, because even though the elk weren't talking, I had identified an area that they would pass through as a transition. And again, this is like needle and haystack sort of stuff. The amount of sign was even limited. Like, it was kind of amazing to think of how big elk are and how they move oftentimes in herds, and you're not seeing scat. You're barely seeing prints. I could find pockets of rubs. And when a bull would bugle during the day, there would be no satellites. Like, it was just a bugle, and it might be 1, 2, maybe 3 bugles, and that was it. And so that's where it proved to be very difficult. But, you know, I use the map apps a lot. I personally use, I've evaluated them on the Hunt Detail YouTube channel, all of them, HuntWise, Onyx, Go Hunt, Spartan Forge, Hunt Stand, Base Map. And I have stuck with Onyx. I also use Go Hunt. I like both of them because they offer something a little bit different. I do think HuntWise is probably the best. If, you know, quite honestly, based on the layers and tools, and you can see that review on the YouTube channel if you want. But I found those to be so incredibly helpful, because when you find sign and you're deep you're hiking in the dark and you're like, think you're going the right direction, but you're actually not. Or if you found a path through some downfall that's effective, or a path that gets you on a primary trail, and you can just, it's so amazing. I just can't imagine not using, or, you know, like years ago when folks didn't have those tools, I'm like, how in the world did you, I mean, I know there's, you know, compass and maps and all paper maps and all that stuff, but my gosh, I probably would have wound up in Mexico if without my Hunt map apps. And I just found them to be so helpful. But, you know, I think, you know, to sort of close this out and not, you know, not belabor some of it. I mean, I do feel like the outcomes were that I am probably, if I'm going to solo hunt, I need to do less dark timber. I need to be able to glass. I need to be able to spot and stalk. I think I'm personally going to do less solo hunting. I think that I enjoy it because I can make decisions more quickly and more efficiently, and I'm not relying on other folks that may not be as prepared or as invested. And it's no fault of theirs. They just have different objectives than I do. But I think I'm going to try to do less solo hunts because I enjoy sort of spitballing with some folks. And it brings me to another point, is that as I was packing up the other day to leave, I didn't realize this, but this other guy that was hunting there, I thought he was with someone else. He was solo hunting as well. And he had been there longer than I had. And we started sharing notes and talking about movement and talking about this and that and encounters. And it was so refreshing. And I just thought, gosh, you know, why did I not make an effort? Again, I thought there were two guys there. I didn't realize it was just one. Had I known it was one, it would have, I honestly think one of us would have filled a tag much more quickly in between sharing notes and covering ground and sort of coming up with game plans. Every time I've met other hunters out in the field, I've always found them to be so positive and supportive and engaging. And if you think about it, when you're out in the field, if you see other hunters that are, especially like archery elk hunting solo, like that's somebody that really, really is committed. And so it's such a small niche of the hunting community. So if you're out in another state and you see another guy solo hunting, or maybe it's just two guys, I just want to encourage you to connect with them. Because last year when I was in Wyoming, I connected with a guy, we still text, and we worked together, we hunted together, and it was great. And he was a resident of that state, and it makes the experience so much richer. And so personally, I think I'm going to do less solo hunting. And personally, I think I'm going to do a better job of connecting with other hunters and chatting with other hunters and even sharing information potentially. Because I think, again, it's such a small tribe of us that it's sort of counterproductive not to. The last thing is more personal. I don't really like tent camping solo. Like if my family was with me, or if, you know, other people are also in a tent and they're camping, it's sort of different. But I think there's a vulnerability there that I'm not comfortable with. So I found myself just sleeping in the front seat of my vehicle. And that to me was more comfortable, more secure. And so I didn't even really, I use my tent every now and then, but not a whole lot. And so, So anyway, those were some of the outcomes for me. I will say when I left, I was excited. And when I made it home, it was very clear that to me that everybody wants me to fill a tag. But at the end of the day, I don't think they really care. There was a sort of a need for me and my presence as a dad, and a need for me and my presence as a husband. And yeah, they're cheering for me. They're supporting me. They want me to fill a tag, and they want to, you know, maybe see me come home with a big set of antlers and hear about the adventure. But at the end of the day, I don't think anybody really cares except you about what you get or what you don't get. And then even yesterday, I was doing dad things that were meaningful, like truly, truly meaningful for my kids and some of the things that they are experiencing as they grow and evolve and that sort of thing. And so it told me that I made the right decision. Not that I was going to stay any longer, but it told me that, yeah, I needed to be back home and doing the things, leading my family and serving my family. So as you're out there, and if you're struggling, and if you're not able to fill a tag, just remind yourself that, well, it's fun and it's important and it's meaningful time for you. At the end of the day, how you love and how you serve and how you lead your family really is the most important thing and the most meaningful thing. I've talked about this before. When I die, you know, the antlers that I've got in the basement, they're going to be sold or given away, or I don't know, maybe my kids will hang on to some of it. I don't know. But at the end of the day, no one is really going to, there's not going to be some giant conference and say, okay, well, we're going to talk about all of these, this great buck that Jacob killed, or this big elk that Jacob killed. And just like, no one's going to wax poetic about that stuff. It's going to be forgotten. It's going to be, and it's not a sad thing. It's just a reality. And so the most important things are how you are leading and loving and serving your family. And I think it's all about sort of perspective when it comes to filling tax. Now, that being said, you know, it's whitetail season. It's deer season for the next few months. And I'm excited about that. And there will be some bloodshed for sure. And I'm excited about that. The next podcast, we're going to talk a little bit about gear, some things that work, some things that didn't. And there is some crossover there between elk and whitetail in terms of that type of gear. And so we'll talk a little bit about some things that worked and didn't work and just about gear in general. But I do want to thank you for your support. I want to thank you for the time. I know this is a little bit longer of an episode. Please like, share, subscribe. Please go to the Hunt Detail YouTube channel and subscribe there. I think you'll find there's some great content there. And best of luck, and we'll talk again next week.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.